So tonight, as part of a Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, Fraud, Failure and Farce, the Land Expropriation Hearings. Isaiah 28 verse 15 says, "We have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we are in agreement. When the overflowing scourge passes through, it will not come to us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood we have hidden ourselves." That is so appropriate for what we are dealing and facing today. We're dealing with people who think they can make a refuge amongst lies and they can make a pact with hell itself. Those of us who attended the parliamentary hearings regarding the African National Congress's plans to confiscate farms were given a classic example of how communist agitation propaganda or active measures works. Now, you may think, what's agitprop? There actually was a department in the Soviet Union called agitprop, short for agitation propaganda. Because propaganda and agitation go together, and the first major application was land reform, of course. You can see, taking land, industries, everything, they want to take every single aspect over. And here you can see the hammer and the sickle, and you can see all the different, so it's the factory workers and the farmers smashing out all opposition. Look what they're putting the hammer on. Peasants, actually, or kulaks, farmers. They were the main enemy, the kulaks. So de-kulakization, getting rid of the kulaks or the farmers. Agitprop could be as subtle as this. You don't want to starve. You don't want to freeze. You don't want to starve. Do you want to eat and drink? Join the labor force, work parties, and the collectives. How subtle is that? And you may think, well, what's it got to do with us? Well, this is South Africa, 2018. And you've got, yep, that's Che Guevara, and that is a 5-point star, black star and red, with a hammer and sickle. And, yep, just like typical communist place, they've always got their idols up front. And the choice of red everywhere, oh, and it does say communist cadre. So you don't need to mistake the fact that, you know what flag this is? Flag of the Southern Communist Party. Now, the Southern Communist Party does not put up candidates in the elections in South Africa. If you go on to the Southern Communist Party website, you will see the SACP is not putting up any candidates in the next elections, but advise all cadres to vote for the ANC candidate. Go on to the CPUSA, Communist Party USA website, and not only can you buy Lenin baseball caps, Lenin t-shirts, and Lenin pens, credit cards accepted, but it says that the Communist Party USA is not putting up any candidates in the next elections, but advises all cadres to vote for the Democratic Party candidate. Now, when they tell you to vote for another party, it means they control that party. Now, we've known that the Southern Communist Party controls the ANC for a very long time. And there hasn't been one ANC president who hasn't been a senior member of the Southern Communist Party. And can anyone identify this delightful fellow? Laid Nzimande, who happened to be at the time Minister, Cabinet Minister for Higher Education in this country. At this time, the fees must fall and the roads must fall and everything else must fall and knowledge must fall and science must fall. You had a Communist Party member. Oh, he was not just a member. He was General Secretary of the Southern Communist Party while he was Minister of Education, Higher Education in the country. Just in case you thought communism's dead and there's no influence in our life today, there are people running around wearing SACP t-shirts. And then, wait a minute, is this a different party? Oh, the EFF. But don't they look like they've got the same color scheme as the Southern Communist Party? Don't they look like, actually, the Communist Party in South Africa? In fact, the EFF is nothing other than the SACP, basically. And this is what they believe of free enterprise. This was these poor, this is the European H&M, H&M. They trashed their stores like this, and I don't know that they've been prosecuted for it. So huge crowds of uniformed EFF and ANC renter mobs were being busted in hours before the event even began. We're talking about now Saturday, the 4th of August in Goodwood. There was a party atmosphere in more ways than one, and the venue, a large Apostolic Faith Mission church, which, by the way, is the same church where we did our planning for the marches on Parliament in 95 and 96. We met every week there, Mondays, for 6 weeks in the preparation, so I know that venue very well. But it was strewn with litter. The disruptive mods made it very hard for any Capetonians to access the venue to give verbal testimony to the parliamentary subcommittee gathered there. Hundreds were not even able to get through the door, and the milled round outside, including members of city council. Met Demi Dudley, for example, outside, and he was standing outside, and he wasn't able to get in. Parliament had originally been advertised as the venue for the hearings, but barely a day before the event, a new venue was announced, leaving to much confusion. In fact, I asked Taryn, she assured me, no, it's just Parliament. But I'm seeing on social media people saying it's been changed to Goodwood, to Friends of God Church. Where's the Friends of God Church? It wasn't called that when I went there last. It was the AFM Church. So there was a lot of confusion. Considering how many municipal buildings and city halls and how Parliament itself is available to the government, it's inexplicable why they had to rent a church venue. What does the government have all these buildings for if they can't use them? Except perhaps they prefer to have a church venue trashed by the renter mob than a government building. Perhaps. It was then pointed out that this venue was ideal for the purpose of the EFF and ANC because it was just across the road from a McDonald's and a KFC. Yep, because it was free food for agitprop renter mob. Reportedly, many of the EFF and ANC renter mob members had been promised free KFC or McDonald's lunches, and from the vast amounts of fast food litter around the grounds of the church after lunch, that certainly seemed to be the case. Now, I didn't notice it, but others, like Christopher Leung, an advocate, pointed out that he saw the buses that came in. He said all of them had Eastern Cape number plates. He said these people weren't even from Cape Town. They were bused in from the Eastern Cape, or Transcar. Considering that each citizen who wanted to give verbal testimony was limited to 3 minutes, now they advertised 3 to 5 minutes, when you got to 3 minutes, strictly 3 minutes, no more than 3 minutes. And they've allocated 5 hours, 11 to 4. That means a maximum of 100 people, 20 an hour, could have spoken. That's assuming everything went on time and they didn't take an age to introduce. As it was, with even the delays and disruptions and going to almost 5 o'clock, less than 80 people out of 2,000 were able to speak of all the people crammed into this building. Notice, by the way, the large amount of yellow ANC t-shirts around them. Then you can see some of the red EFFs as well. This just gives you a bit of a feel. Kicking off the hearing, the chairman of the proceedings informed everyone that this was a sitting of Parliament. Not like a sitting of Parliament. It was a sitting of Parliament, he kept saying. Therefore, everyone needed to behave accordingly. Sort of wondered what that meant. No politicizing, no shouting, no clapping, no booing, no disruptive behavior would be tolerated. Sounded promising. The chairman then assured us that the parliamentarians sitting on this platform were only present to listen. They would not be saying a single word, not the whole day. They've come to hear the people of Cape Town, come to hear you. We want to hear what you've got to say. And this is then repeated in Khoza. They assured us beginning that they'd repeated in all 3 official languages, English, Khoza, Afrikaans. But when the translator is about to repeat the instruction in Afrikaans, he is told not to bother. Just like that. After telling us the members of Parliament would not say a single word all day, the chairman then gave each parliamentarian an opportunity to introduce themselves. Which seemed to contradict what he just said, but I suppose these guys are pathological liars and I don't even know the meaning of words. Member of Parliament Steve Swartz of the African Christian Democratic Party greeted everyone in the name of our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ, reminded all present that we were gathered in the house of God and should behave accordingly, and there's some abuse shouted at him from some of the mob gathered. Well, that was about the high point, and it was downward hill after that. Then followed an incredible scene of one EFF member, which I think stands for Everything for Free Party, standing up of the parliamentary committee on the platform, making rousing political statements and shouting slogans which encourage mob hysteria, screams and dancing by the unruly members and supporters in the crowd. In fact, it seemed that they were there for just that purpose. So a lot of people, if for no other purpose than to scream when they shout, "Amanda, no, wait," and other sort of slogans like that. Now, considering the EFF only obtained around 6% of the votes countrywide in the last national elections, much less than that in Cape Town, that's for sure, it's extraordinary to see 12 of the 23 members of the parliamentary committee were EFF. I mean, just look at the red outlets up there. Just start us. Now, where's the DA? This is meant to be a DA constituency, you heard. Although the Democratic Alliance are meant to be the majority party in the Western Cape, We only noticed one person representing DA stand up from the floor to give any reaction to proposed amendment of Section 25 of the Constitution. In fact, I even heard the person. I asked others, and somebody said they'd heard someone who identified himself as DA. But I didn't see DA people in the venue, but I saw a lot of DA people gathering on the other side of the road. They had some kind of meeting outside. I saw a whole lot wearing blue tick. But if they're the majority party in the Western Cape, why were they absent from the fight? Totally absent from the fight. We didn't hear from them. I mean, they were, in fact, none of them on the platform as part of the parliamentary committee even objected in point of order to the abuse of the rules continually. So the DA were around, and the DA are able to go to the old matches, but it seems they're incapable of confronting the enemy in an event like this, which is where it really counts. So shame on them. Cowards and deserters. The vast majority of those chosen by the chairman to represent our concerns in the Cape, as they put it, were uniformed EFF and ANC rent-a-mob, plainly. Very few supporters of ACDP, Freedom Front, or Cape Party were granted any opportunity to speak, and almost no DA supporters were in evidence inside the venue. So did you get the impression they were boycotting?
Yeah, they were boycotting. That's the word. They boycotted. They weren't going to go.
Well, that's a bit pointless. It's like a soldier boycotting the battle. Shame on him. That's a fat lot of use, isn't it? Well, they adopt the idols of the ANC, so they might as well adopt their slogans too. They adopted a lot of their policies. Yes, my co-conspirator in counter-revolution, Michel Lemay, got me ahead in the queue. And who's this solidarity chap? National Front. Daniel. Yes, Daniel Lotto. So, we were distinctly ignored, even though our arms were up to, as opportunities to that we wanted to speak. Interesting, when asked who wants to speak, very few people raised their hands. So the vast majority weren't there to speak, and from those who were sleeping, vast weren't even there to listen, and they were just to take our seats. Throughout the over 5 hours of this hearing, the chairman continued to choose uniformed EFF and ANC people as the predominant amount of members of the public permitted to give any kind of verbal testimony. Time and again, you'd hear the chairman choose, speak, saying, the man with the red beret, the man wearing the yellow ANC t-shirt, the lady with the ANC headdress, the man in the red EFF shirt, the man in the red EFF jacket, the man wearing the ANC shirt, literally. So you've got to be kidding. And did any of them have anything intelligent to say? Not in your life. At the by-election last year in Brackenfell, the DA received about 70% of the vote. The Cape Party received 19% of the vote. And the Freedom Front received 9% of the vote. ACDP, ANC and EFF all received less than 1% of the vote. EFF got 0.01% of the vote. Now, fair enough, that's just one major area of Cape Town, Brackenfell. But there's no doubt that the vast majority of voters in South Africa support, in Cape Town, support the DA, and only a very small minority support the EFF. The EFF is not a major party in the Cape. You would never have known that from these so-called hearings in Goodwood on the 4th of August on Saturday. Although there were quite a fair number of Cape Party supporters wearing their distinctive shirts, can't miss them, none of them were chosen to speak. Not one was selected. Vast amounts of EFF who, I mean, they're not even really a Cape Party at all. In the end, when one person supporting the Cape Party but not wearing any Cape Party identification stopped to speak, she's actually assaulted by members of the rent-a-mob in the upper gallery. And fortunately, her husband and Carla were close enough to grab this person and pin him down as he was trying to assault her because he didn't like what she's saying. When Jack Miller of the Cape Party stood up to speak, the abusive threats and shouting so drowned him out it was hard to hear most of what he said. Now you can go onto the Cape Party on the Cape Republic Facebook page and see the video. You can see it. You have trouble hearing what he said because it was non-stop constant heckling. You could not make out most of what was being said. Everybody listened quietly and respectfully to the endless repetition of radical communist rhetoric and repeating of mindless slogans. Repetitive is the word. Just nothing new. Nothing even intelligent. Yet the moment anyone started to comment critically, and by the way, you'll notice Eugene over there, one of our friends from Cross the Bunter Mission, But when anyone spoke critically or with common sense on a proposed amendment to Section 25 of the Constitution, they were shouted down by increasingly loud and abusive threats and insults. Now, Eugene managed to get through most of it with not too much abuse, but they got more confident because the chairman let them get away with it, that they got more and more abusive and more loud as the day progressed. Although the chairman on numerous occasions said that I will not warn you again. No shouting, no booing or heckling. The abuse of shouting, heckling, blatant politicization was not just tolerated, it was actually encouraged because the noise became so deafening you couldn't hear what many individuals were saying. You could tell it was positive because they were being shouted out. Because if they were speaking communist nonsense, then nobody would heckle. Despite the use of microphones and a PA system. Now, looking around the chaotic scene inside the Friends of God Church in Goodwood, you could see huge swathes of area dominated by red berets of the EFF or the yellow shirts and jackets and headdresses of the ANC. You could also see young people. I mean, some of these people are really young. I didn't see these little girls in front of us ever raise their hand to want to speak. What were they there for? They weren't there to speak. In fact, later they were sleeping. Many of these were just teenagers, and most of the people around there had no intention of taking part in it. Their only purpose was to occupy seats to ensure that most of the Capetonians who came to participate in the hearings would not have space inside and be forced to remain voiceless outside. In fact, one of our friends reported back in the media workshop we held on Saturday. She said she is sitting next to an EFF chairman. He identified himself as the EFF chairman for Cape Town. And while she's talking to him, a couple of the organizers came running up in their outfits and said, the people are getting restless. They want their KFC now and drinks. And he quickly got on the phone and ordered and said, vehicles are coming. And it's that blatant. They were not even hiding the fact that they had come promised free food, free drinks and so on. This was rent-a-mob. The Joint Constitutional Review Committee's public hearings, that's what they called it, on amending Section 25 of the Constitution seemed to have been a complete fraud. Even before the hearings began in the Western Cape, ANC President, for want of a better word, Cyril Ramaphosa, announced that no matter what, the ANC is going ahead with expropriation of land from whites without compensation. We can take the land from the whites and give it to our people, he said. Our people. So we're not their people. We're not South Africans now. It was a farce. Because no attempt was made to enforce the rules and blatant politicizing and slogan shouting. The chairman was beyond worthless, absolutely worthless. Mob rule was not just tolerated, it was encouraged by members of the committee who would stand up and shout their political slogans and whip the people up like knee-jerk reaction. And I saw this and took a picture of this, and Alicia goes with me, looked at this, and when she looked at the people standing around her, they said, yes, you deserve this. An axe? Why? Instead of reasoned debate and discussion, considering facts and evidence of case studies in recent history, repetitive shouting of slogans and deliberate wasting of time ensured that the majority of Capetonians who had come to contribute to the discussion were not able to be heard. That was the purpose. It was plainly a failure. Fraud, failure, and farce. Because if the intention had been to investigate whether it was necessary to amend Article 25 of the Constitution, considering how they tolerated mobs of uniform political agitators to fill much of the venue and to dominate the vast majority of the hearings, this had to be totally planned, orchestrated. Nobody could be that stupid. It couldn't have just happened by accident. Now, as a missionary who has served suffering people throughout Africa for over 37 years, it is clear to me that the planned expropriation without compensation would be counterproductive, if the aim is to help the people, that is. In every case where expropriation without compensation has been implemented, the result has been far greater poverty and suffering for the poor and for the most vulnerable. The case studies include Soviet Union, Stalin Soviet Union, where dekulakization land reform, they called it land reform, resulted in the hunger plague, the Holodomor, which killed 11 million people and displaced 18 million people who lost their homes. Yes, they had the red flags as well. And yes, they had this, oh, look at those happy looking farmers over there. And these wonderful big tractors of the 5-year plan. And yep, here you can see the Politburo local commissars with banners and so on are overseeing the people who used to farm their family farm, and now they have the joy of farming some collective where everything goes to the state. And yes, literally all their produce, everything they had, all their grain stocks were shipped out deliberately to starve the people. This was grain confiscations in the Ukraine. And is this not pitiful? This is a political propaganda picture. This isn't something smuggled out. And some of the people are actually smiling for the pictures and so on, as they've been urged to. And you can see some of the uniformed guards standing around watching these people on their hands and knees having to deal with the farms. I mean, where are the tractors that they keep talking about in the five-year plans? And these are actual Ukrainian children wasting away. This was reported at the time. People knew. I mean, before the Second World War, before Britain and America poured in billions and trillions of dollars and pounds worth of aid and sent them Spitfires and Sherman tanks and everything else, they knew that millions of Russians had been systematically starved to death as policy by Stalin before they happily sat together and called them allies fighting for freedom. Holodomor, it comes from the Ukrainian words holo, which is hunger, and mor, which is plague, so it's a hunger plague, murder by starvation. There are people who still try to remember this, because nobody in Hollywood seems interested in commemorating it. Most people know nothing about the genocide of Ukrainians 1932 to 1933, which is called land reform. But they do have a memorial in Ukraine, and it's been dramatized in a film that came out last year, Bitter Harvest, which is well worth seeing. It's a accurate, honest, but manages to maintain a positive spirit of resistance. Doesn't get so stuck into showing you the horrors, but you know what's going on, even though most of it's off camera. But Bitter Harvest, well worth seeing. It's part of our library here. Red China, where Mao Zedong's great cultural revolution was the second phase of the revolution there, it destroyed millions of lives, thousands of years of Chinese history and culture, and led to widespread famine. However, when you see the political pictures, boy, does this look good. And, well, not only is this completely unrealistic, but why are they showing you a picture of it, a portrait, when you could have a photograph? Why don't they have a photograph of these happy people with the super abundant crops? And look at those bananas there and so on. I mean, this looks really great. And, yep, Chairman Mao's picture's on the wall. Little kitty's got the Communist Party flag. And the people look well-dressed, happy. Even the chicken looks happy. And, I mean, this is propaganda. Okay, now we get to the photographs. Look at this. Look at the spontaneous joy of the people. And they all managed to bring out a picture, exactly the same picture and the same size. Nevertheless, it's obviously a spontaneous expression of their love and devotion to the chairman of the Communist Party, Chairman Mao. And here you see these happy little Red Brigade Communist Party youth characters with the red scarves marching off. Now, this is why the second phase of the revolution normally happens about 20 years after the political first phase of the revolution. You need a generation of people who didn't know what it was like to grow up in nationalist China or Tsarist Russia or Ian Smith's Rhodesia or apartheid South Africa. And so you've got a new generation of born frees who don't have a clue what they're talking about, like Jews, who can then be ruthless with... Now, this is a farmer. So this is land reform in China. Farmers being tied up. And now a key part of this is something akin to TRC. Your goal is to humiliate the elders, the farmers, the pastors, the leaders, the teachers, the journalists, the intelligentsia, whoever were those represent the past, the priests, whatever. And they'd bring them before the population, and they would have to confess their crimes, and they'd be humiliated. And they'd shave their heads, they'd drag them out in front of the people, and they'd stand them on a box where they'd have to confess their crimes and be written for those who didn't, who weren't able to hear. And they'd have to endure abuse. You can see this person's had all kinds of things thrown over him. Maybe that's even his blood on his shirt. And then finally, after humiliating them long enough, they would have them killed. This is land reform, second phase of the revolution in China. 69 million people died in the second phase of the revolution, the Great Cultural Revolution in China. The Great Famine. Would you believe, after all the land reform, people starved by the millions? Who would have guessed? Who could have anticipated it? The Red Terror under Mengistu in Ethiopia. I remember at school, we had to raise money for the starving in Ethiopia. Ethiopia used to export food. Ethiopia has the potential to feed. The whole of Africa could have been fed from Ethiopia. Ethiopia used to export food until the communists took over. Land reform under Mengistu. Here's Colonel Mengistu. And again, see any comparison and color of flags that the people like? Why is it always red? And this is part of the land reform. The biggest forced removal since the Second World War. They forced about 18 million people away from their homes and their farms. And people died by the millions. Some of them they helped along the way with public hangings. And we saw pictures like this. As in school, I remember, we had to raise money for the children starving in Ethiopia. Why were they starving in Ethiopia? Land reform. Communist land reform. Socialism. Karl Marx in action. And do you know how they handled the relief aid? On my first visit to Germany for Christian Action back in 1987, I was in a group where I had a dinner with a whole lot of sponsors of the Kirchen Tag, and I was sitting right next to a Daimler-Benz, Mercedes-Benz director. He's a very high-level person. He had just come back from Ethiopia, so I was fascinated to find out more about Ethiopia. What were you there for? Well, he says the Ethiopian government insists that all relief aid that comes to Ethiopia must be accompanied by 18-wheeler Mercedes-Benz trucks. They've got to be Daimler-Benz trucks and to transport the relief aid that World Vision or Band-Aid are donating to them, Tear Fund and so on. Oh, so why were you there? He says, well, you see, he says they make quite an industry out of this. So if somebody wants to give, say, $1 million worth of aid to Ethiopia, they've got to pay $1 million tax, so 100% import tax on the free relief aid. And they've got to bring a certain amount of Daimler-Benz trucks in to transport those things. And when they come there, the trucks have to be signed over to the Ethiopian government to distribute them. So they can't take them back once they've finished the transportation. And so he said, I was there because they were having one of the regular complaints that these trucks had broken down. I said, trucks broke down? He says, our trucks are well made. He said, but they're not designed to carry T-62 tanks on the back. These Daimler-Benz trucks bought by relief agencies are being used to transport tanks? Yes, he says, the food's rotting on the dockside or being exported to Cuba or Russia or Romania, and the trucks that have been bought by the relief agencies in order to transport the food is being used to transport Russian tanks. He said these tanks can't travel as far in the distances and the roads are very bad too. So they are using our trucks, which are not made for transporting a 60-ton tank on the back of it. So I said, so what do you say? He said, well, we said that if they persisted with this foolishness, we would expose to the world what they're doing. I said, are they doing this? He said, yes. Are you going to expose? No, why not? He said, well, we're sending a lot of trucks to Ethiopia. That was just one insight, and I'm abbreviating a whole evening of insights into what goes on, how you run a famine. Communist countries are past masters in organizing famine. And a key part of famine is you've got to get rid of the farmers. How can you possibly sell bottled water to people unless you create a water shortage? And so on. The disastrous land reforms of Julius Nyerere in Tanzania are also worth looking at, because he actually apparently really meant well. He didn't intend to starve the people to death intentionally. It happened. At least he wasn't machine gunning the people to death like they were in China. But even his well-meaning socialist plans were complete and utter total catastrophe and failure and was later banned. And Nyerere even admitted it was a failure, to his credit. Then there's the catastrophic famine that resulted from Samora Machel's communist land reform in Mozambique. By the way, here you can see four of the worst socialists out there. From Bob Mugabe, that dates this one, and Kenneth Gunda, absolute catastrophe. Samora Machel, and there's old Sam Nujoma, the least educated leader in Africa, at least before Zuma, at least. I think he had a... was the Great Four stand for? And, yes, you find Uncle Fidel Castro turns up for every revolution. He's always there to guide his proteges in extending the Cuban colonies in Africa. And I came across churches where youngsters were being forcibly sent off to be slaves in the Cuban sugarcane plantations to pay for the Cuban troops of burning down their churches. You couldn't even have them burn your churches and kill your people for free. They had to send their children over to be slaves in the sugarcane plantation of Cuba. Think how many people are angry about the slaves that worked in American plantations in Georgia in the 1850s, which is about 170 years ago. But they don't care about the slaves in the Cuban communist fields in our lifetime. I took this picture. Russian ships that come in, laden with tanks, trucks, helicopter gunships, and debarra, going out also low in the water. Low. Why do they take out food? I took these pictures of children dying of starvation, mothers emaciated. These children died of starvation within the week. We took them vitamin-enriched milk. It was too late. When you see skulls and bones, human skulls and bones around a fire, you know that cannibalism is back. That's how bad it got in Mozambique. 1 million people died of starvation in Mozambique under the... This is a green country, which grows pineapples wildly and so on, which used to export food. This was land reform in Mozambique. I've documented that in the killing fields of Mozambique. The complete destruction of the once agriculturally rich food exporting Angola, and more recently Robert Mugabe's catastrophic land confiscations in neighboring Zimbabwe. How many case studies would people like? In fact, could they name us one single case in history where expropriation without compensation has ever resulted in increased food production and food security, as our present premier wants to tell us? Robert Mugabe's insane hatred and greed led to this. This is land reform in Zimbabwe, before and after. Exactly the same home. See the where the chimney is? See the entrance? That's the same place. That's land reform. And these are land reformers. And this is the result of land reform. And this was a home. And two male, two pale, wrong color, beaten, murdered. And again, we see just a few examples of land reform in Zimbabwe. And change is not necessarily progress. And they might speak about hope and change, but the hope is normally ill-founded. And the whole country gets overloaded and everything falls to pieces, just like this bucky will not last. And what did they use before ox-drawn carts? Vehicles. What they used before electricity? What they used before candles and kerosene lamps? Electricity. This is change in Zimbabwe. And this is land reform. And it is a deception. Land reform deception. Political opportunism in Zimbabwe's land seizure era. Catherine Buckle is a real bleeding heart liberal. She is as liberal as they come. She's one of these people who really believed in the Mugabe Zimbabwe. And she's documented how her farm was destroyed, taken, everything else. And she really tried everything. And she is one of these super excited over the overthrow of Mugabe end of last year. And Catherine Buckle, she writes African Tears. She went to register to vote. They were all very happy to have her being registered to vote until the supervisor came and said, no, she's white, she can't. But she's born Zimbabwean. No, can't register to vote. So someone born Zimbabwe has poured a whole heart and soul in Zimbabwe a whole life. Still too pale. Well, the people in Zimbabwe have suffered long enough to know Mugabe's a liar and Mugabe's starving his own people. Well, yes. That's pretty obvious to anyone who's been in Zimbabwe. We know why you're in South Africa. Life in Zimbabwe is murder these days. Indeed. No jokes. Political power is built on the backs of the poor. In every single case, dictators accumulated more power even while they violated their promises and oppressed the very people they claimed to be serving. And this is the main thing. Forget the verbiage. Forget what they're saying. It's all a distraction. It's all a lie. This is what these politicians do all the time. Whether the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Cambodian Revolution, the Vietnam, this isn't just Africa, this is everywhere. This is the way revolutionaries work. They promise the earth, land, peace, whatever. And the fact that the very people who've been the forefront of the revolution are just cannon fodder and they're going to die of starvation or get shot in the back of the head or flee. Do you think the people up top care? Stalin, Mao, Mengistu, Mugabe, Ramaphosa? Why would they care? This is what they think of the people. Beating these women who gathered for prayer outside a government building in the eve before an election. Land expropriation are always disastrous. They guarantee pathways to starvation every single time. A century of socialist economic failures apparently proves nothing. This time it's going to be different. Okay, it's failed everywhere else, but not this time. Evicting capable, experienced farmers from land their families have carved out of wilderness and out of thorn bushes and cultivated, it'll curtail food production. It'll create hardships. It'll create unemployment. Obviously, socialist land reform always leads to starvation in the cities. Now, people in the countryside might be able to eke out a subsistence farming existence, but what can the people in the cities do? In Harare and in Bulawayo, the people had to flee back to the countryside. They couldn't sustain their life in the cities, but they had a place to go back to, and Zimbabwe is mostly rural. So, or even though half the Zimbabwean population fled, they had a place to go. They fled to Mozambique, they fled to Zambia, they fled to Botswana and South Africa, and they fled to the countryside. Places like Bulawayo were almost depopulated for a time during the worst of this. But where are the South Africans going to flee? Most South Africans don't have rural connections. This is what land reform looks like in Zimbabwe. And don't worry, you can buy some rats. The goal is not farming, the goal is looting. When you see these people exuberantly excited there, it's not that they want to have hard work. Farming is hard work. It takes expertise, it takes experience. As the Zimbabwean experience showed, most of those advocating expropriation without compensation are not interested in getting up early to plow the fields and milk the cows. They don't want to get up with the chickens, you're kidding. Most are not interested in cultivating crops at all. They just want to loot productive farms, smash the equipment, burn their farms and homes, and go back to the city to watch TV. That's the truth. We want land. We demand the land. We're going to burn things. But here's the facts. South African land reform. Okay. According to the Restitution of Land Rights Act signed by Mandela in 1994, they have, since 1994, the Land Rights Act has settled 77,000 claims. They've acquired over 3 million hectares of farmland. They have compensated 371,000 families. That means people who wanted to get money instead of the land. Beneficiaries, 1.8 million people have benefited. Total cost to date, 29 billion rand. The government has paid. Now that sounds like a lot of money. But bear in mind that every year they bail out SAA to the tune of over 5 billion, and they spend more than 15 billion on VIP security for parliamentarians and so on. But anyway, so that's an interesting thing. Notice the land claims. Notice where most land claims have been done. Western Cape, 210. The Western Cape's done a lot. Limpopo's done a whole two. One in northwest, four in Gauteng and so on. So they're not doing very well on land claims. This is now just 2013-2014. The report on land reform has shown that the reason why land reform has failed so far is primarily because of corruption and incompetence. Now, this is the government's own report done by the caretaker president between Mbeki and Zuma. McLean? Yes, exactly. That one. The one whose name I struggle to pronounce. He just chaired an investigation which has taken a few years into land reform. And he basically came to the conclusion that it's not that there's not enough willing sellers for willing buyers. It's not that there's not enough land in the hands of the government. It's that there's been massive corruption. And the reason why they haven't been very successful in these provinces is because there's higher rates of corruption and incompetence in these, who are all appointees of the ANC, mind you. Here's a fact. White South Africans own 357,000 hectares of urban land and 26 million hectares of agricultural land. South Africa's 122 million hectares, which means white people privately own 22% of the land, most of which is in the Karoo and the Kalahari and is pretty arid and almost desert. So who owns the other 78%? Well, either government or black people. So this business of, you know, 80% or 90% of the best farming land, well, why is it called the best farming land? Well, because they've made it the best farming land. Over 10 years ago, Dr. Philip Du Toit wrote The Great South African Land Scandal, where he looked at willing buyer, willing seller land reform, where they'd take a productive farm from one farmer and then they'd give it to a co-op or whatever and run by some government official, and disaster. You know, they cooked and bred all of dairy cows and all sorts of dumb things, just destroyed, wrecked, messed up. And many of these farms, the farm workers have ended up in squatter camps in town because they used to live nice lives and on a farm, and now the farm's derelict. They can't even sustain themselves and their families. And so it's one scandal after another. The southern government is at this moment sitting on over 4,000 farms that were handed over by previous white owners, willing buyer, willing seller, but were never transferred to black owners. Why don't they just start the farms they got in their hand? They've got more land than actually all the farmers do. Why interfere with a commercially capable, experienced farmer? Recent history demonstrates the disaster of government interference in the economy, in any economy, whatever the government gets involved in. If they set minimum wages, they create unemployment. Whatever they do, they set prices, next thing you can't find materials. Like in Zimbabwe, Mugabe set the price of bread. And the baker said, but it'll cost us more to produce it than we can sell it for, so we're not going to produce the bread. Next thing, you couldn't get bread in Zimbabwe. Yeah, it's that kind of, every time a government interferes in market economy, and governments can't understand market economy anyway. I mean, if they could do business, they'd be doing business. There wouldn't be politicians there. It also demonstrates the disaster of breaking God's commands. You shall not steal. And thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. Not even the oxen who pulls a plow, the means of production. Providential property is written into the Ten Commandments. And so you get Juju, who knows nothing about anything apparently. The time for reconciliation is over. Now is the time for justice. And how do you get justice? By stealing. We must ensure we restore the dignity of our people. How do you restore the dignity of black people? By making them thieves, liars, racists, murderers, and have them starving to death where they've got to beg for food from foreign aid? How does that restore anyone's dignity? This is 1984 George Orwell newspeak. Missionaries are busy caring for the casualties of just such irresponsible political decisions made in Zimbabwe, in the Congo, and other socialist experiments. Like this in Zimbabwe, in Sudan, and in Ethiopia, in Eritrea. Yes. All over Africa, you've got people starving as a result of just such mindless, short-sighted socialist experiments based on hate, greed, and covetousness. How do you restore people's dignity? By getting them in line to beg food from some Peace Corps liberal leading heart from America who has probably voted for Hillary and comes out to help the victims of their kind of policies that they advocate anyway. Let's not follow in the footsteps of failure. And there's quite a few failures around that you can just see. We drive across Africa, and if we stopped for every time we saw a wreck of a 18-wheeler truck, we wouldn't get to our destination in time. You could take no end of those pictures. But I suspect that the present policy of expropriation without compensation is being cynically promoted to distract voters from the failure of government. The failure of government and the looting of the country by excessive taxation, inflation, and corruption. That's the trio that's responsible for most of the problems in a country. Corruption, inflation, and taxation. Those are the three big giants that are causing almost all of our problems. Get rid of those three, and we've solved our problem. Together, we move South Africa forward. Really. It's like they're moving us backwards, actually. They can't even spell school. They can't even handle litter. They can't even handle pollution. They cannot even clean the streets. They can't even deal with crime. They can't deal with lawlessness and violence. In fact, they incite it. When you've got government leaders speaking irresponsibly, saying that all of our problems are the fault of the whites, and all of our problems are the faults of the colonials, and if we can just burn enough things and destroy enough things, you're going to get paradise. Sort of like the Darwinian evolutionary social theory. The whole world came as a result of a big explosion. So if you could just burn enough things down, blow enough things up, paradise will come in the morning, surely. This has got to help. I mean, this is going to bring prices down. It's going to make service delivery so much easier. If you can just loot enough things, burn enough things, everything's going to get better. This is the result of irresponsible politicians. They're encouraging the destruction of property. If you don't respect life and property, you can't have civilization. How can we live in community with people if you've got one group teaching their people to hate and to resent another group of people? That's a recipe for civil war. That's a recipe for chaos, disaster. And these are people's lives being wrecked and ruined. This in Hout Bay, of course, which welcomed the squatters in with their liberal enthusiasm. And after giving them so much generosity, they were rewarded by the very people there that they've been helping burning everything out. Even fire brigade stations. What's going to happen when a fire brigade station's vehicles are all burned out? Well, they can't come and help you when your house on fire. Blocking roads, burning things on roads. Roads cost a lot to build. I've got a suspicion he's not carrying that hammer to repair something. Looting shops. Now notice, these are some small shops. And of course, nothing says freedom more than looting a bottle store. And a lot of these are actually small shops. And many of these people may not have insurance or be people who have put their entire life into the shop. And you loot the shop and you've destroyed some family's life and livelihood. How can the police not notice that this is being stolen? You can't exactly put this in your pocket. And again, these are just family businesses which are destroying families. May Day this year, just on the N3, just at the Mooi River toll gate, they looted and burned out 39 Pentechnicons, each of which must have cost who knows how many millions in terms of the vehicle and the contents. Where were the police? Why is it that they can only turn up for forensics afterwards? These people can give you a speeding ticket, but they can't seem to protect property. And Cape Town, burning out the railways. This is not going to help. But the police are on it. And, yep, this is what we've got now, the new South African Police Service. And they are as asleep as the politicians in charge. And by the way, in case you thought Zuma and Ramaphosa were enemies, in case you thought that Julius and Cyril are opponents, in case you thought that the DA and the EFF are on opposite ends of the spectrum, bear in mind they're in alliance together in several cities around this country. For over 20 years, the poorest South Africans have loyally voted for the ANC. And for the past 20-odd years, they've been slowly becoming poorer, actually becoming poorer. The ANC's become very wealthy. That's the way socialism works. You vote ANC if you want an abundance of crime, legalized rape, steal from whites, corruption, increase in fraud, and be the new Zimbabwe. So what's our Christian response to race politics? Race politics is highly irresponsible. We need to learn to love our neighbor, not to covet and envy and hate and resent. We need a Christian work ethic, not socialist greed and yet another failed state. We've got enough failed states. Think of the billions of rand wasted, squandered every year by the ANC on VIP protection for parliamentarians. The Blue Light Brigade. If we experienced what that was like for the first time this week. And they have a lot of money to protect the parliamentarians, even while I want to take away your ability to protect yourself. And think of the billions of rand they squander every year on bailing out the South African Airways. which used to be not just economically viable, but SAA in the 1970s and 80s was regularly voted one of the top 10 airlines in the world, and sometimes even the top airline. Sometimes we'd even push Swiss Air out, and SAA would be the top airline in the world for service. Well, I think we'd be lucky if we were not in the bottom 10 right now. We're probably somewhere down in number 100 or something. The SAA standards are so shocking. I will not fly SAA if I have any choice at all. But we pour more money into SAA than into land reform. Because think of the difference between Britain and America, how they ended slavery. Britain ended slavery by voting £20 million, that's in 1833, which compensated the owners so that they would not mind setting the slaves free, and provided training and tools for the freed slaves so that they would be able to set themselves up in business. And the British paid £20 million and avoided a war. The Americans lost 650,000 people killed in a civil war, which cost billions of dollars. So which is the better way? Without compensation or with compensation? The Southerners were all willing to set free their slaves, as we said, but we paid investment to to Yankee Northerners who sold them to us in the first place and brought them across the Atlantic. We want some return on investment. And if they just compensated, they would have. I'm not saying it's morally equivalent, but if you want something, pay for it. It's actually cheaper than going the war route. Think of the billions squandered bailing out the state-controlled Eskom, the so-called electricity provider, which is run at a loss all the time, despite us paying more and more and more for less and less. All of this money could have been better spent investing in agriculture and training rural farmers and other entrepreneurs. Stop greed, stop Eskom. I can only agree. AgriSA, in a 2018 transformation report released in April this year, reports on spending over $331 million, this is a private initiative, on transformation initiatives nationally, with 109,000 black farmers benefiting from their training and development, mentorship and farming initiatives. Now, it's quite clear that private initiatives, private enterprise, such as these, are far more effective and far more sustainable model. They've achieved more with their $331 million than the state has with their billions and billions and billions, which have actually gone backwards. So leave private, when it comes to feeding, for example, or starving, whether you're talking about Zimbabwe or Sudan, let private groups like Samaritan's Purse deal with it. They'll do it far better, person to person, church to church, mission to community. When governments get involved and you get NGOs, UN, World Food Program, the result is more corruption, more starvation, more suffering, but there's a few top elite ones, they do well out of it. That's surely far better than the failed state land grabs, which have only led to greater poverty and starvation around the world. This is evident everywhere it's been implemented. I mean, this ship was well named. Karl Marx was a catastrophe and a disaster. Karl Marx's wife committed suicide. Two of his daughters committed suicide. He must have been a bundle of lots to live with. Three of his children died of starvation. Karl Marx never did a day's work in his life. All of his economic theories have failed when implemented everywhere. And yet he's taught in our cultures like he's an authority on economics. He's an absolute total catastrophe. Karl Marx is one of the most reprehensible people ever to have wasted oxygen on planet Earth. Expropriation without compensation is in blatant violation of our constitution. What is Section 25? Private ownership property. No one shall be deprived of private ownership property without just and fair compensation according to market prices. Now, it's not unreasonable. It's even saying they can come to a person and take their land, but they've got to compensate them. Now, expropriation with compensation can be really bad. But without compensation, it's just theft. It's illegal by our own Bill of Rights and by our own laws. And by the way, this isn't just speaking about farms. Section 25 deals with property. That means your intellectual property, your cell phone, your car, any property. This isn't just speaking about farms. It'll affect all of us. It's dangerous to erode constitutional safeguards. To give a politician more power is suicidal. They will take more power, and it'll be at our expense. It would be catastrophic to break our own laws for political opportunism, especially for such unreliable people as these. It would be economic suicide to violate the laws of God and the laws of economics. To chase away employers, investors, and tourists would result in millions more unemployed and much greater suffering and even starvation. The amount of people here, well, it's been 24 years and it's not enough. Now it's time for us to... Don't they see the problem? They keep voting for socialist, corrupt, political opportunists to hold to failed socialist theories, who liars, thieves, who fill their bank accounts in their pockets, who are fat on the land, living on the gravy train. The problem is the people you keep voting for. It's not to suddenly give them more power so they could stay in power for longer, a la Mugabe. It would be insane to destroy our productive agricultural sector with this highly irresponsible political scheme. That's putting it mildly. Expropriation without compensation would be a betrayal of the vision of a united, colorblind South Africa, where never, 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 never again will any South African be discriminated against on the basis of their hate. Who said that? Oh, Uncle Nelson, yes. A revolutionary must become a cold killing machine motivated by pure hate. It doesn't seem to fit somehow. That's like, where does this fit into good neighborliness? Just this year, 1st of January till 31st July, 43 farm murders. But a lot more attacks, 288 attacks. Notice there's more attacks than murders, meaning most of the attacks fail. Which means, despite the attackers having the advantage of numbers, weapons, and surprise, farmers are still managing to defend themselves effectively, which is extraordinary. Oldest victim on a farm being attacked, 88. And this is just speaking about the last 7 months, first 7 months of this year. Look at this kind of blasphemy you get from Black Land First Leader. Indeed. Every time I hear the name Jesus, I'm reminded of white people. I'm glad he won't come back. If he comes back, we will kill him again and cremate his body. Now, you know, good luck to this low-life scumbag, because one day he's going to call for the mountains to fall on him. He'd rather be buried under an avalanche and face the wrath of the Lamb of God when he comes back as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And Jesus Christ came as a Savior the first time. The next time he's not coming as Savior, he's coming as Judge. King of kings, Lord of lords, and as a conqueror. And these fools who make these kind of blasphemous statements, they will be screaming out for the mountains to cover them. It is a fundamental principle of justice that a person is innocent until proven guilty. Due process of law is essential. Checks and balances are vital. No person should be deprived of their property without due process in court, with all reasonable opportunities to defend themselves against any and all charges. These lands were not stolen. These lands are hectare of wilderness. These farms, in many cases, like in Franschhoek, have been possessed by families for 8, 10, 12 generations in some cases. How can you say that this land is not owned by the people whose family's been there from great-grandfather onwards, but somebody who just came into the Western Cape last week, he's got the right to go and take it. How's that not theft? This is actually, when you get down to it, not just greed, not just hate, anti-Christian, the desires to break the power of Christianity in this country. You cannot pronounce a whole people group guilty of any crime. It's not rational, nor is it fair. If any individual is stolen or expropriated without compensation, let that be tested in a court in accordance with the law. We've got enough laws against theft. If there's been expropriation without compensation, take it to court, prove it, give a person a chance to defend themselves, and if there's been theft, then let's see restitution done. But to suddenly declare to everyone all this is just a cover for crime. Don't do anything against your neighbor you wouldn't want done to yourself. Do to others what you'd want done to yourself. Restitution must be done by a convicted criminal to the victims directly and entirely. Restitution is always personal. It's not political. It's not right for people who did not do any crime to be required to do restitution to people who were not the victim. Restitution is not meant to be a scam for politicians to go on a vote while they loot the country for corruption, taxation, inflation. If our government really wants to help the poor, they must stop stealing from them by corruption. They're the biggest thieves of all. The African Union estimates that 25% of the gross domestic product is stolen by corruption by government every single year. 25%. Over a trillion rand is stolen by our government every year, not even counting what privatized criminals do. We're just talking about the nationalized criminals. Corruption is killing us. If the ANC wants to empower the poor, how about giving them legal title deeds to their own homes so that they may have collateral with which to secure loans? Do you know, in the 24 years of the worthless existence of the ANC, they haven't given title deeds for people in the townships, for example. They can't get a loan because they don't own their land. If the state wants to create jobs and grow the economy, then they must respect private ownership of property. They must not erode constitutional safeguards. Because if they erode constitutional safeguards, they'll chase away investors, entrepreneurs, tourists, and job creators. And every one of these skilled workers provides employment for 10 unskilled workers. And so the millions of white South Africans chased out of this country have resulted in 30 million unemployed black people in this country. We had about 2 million unemployed in 1994 when Mandela became president, the total population 29 million. Now we've got 30 million unemployed in a country of 58 million. We have increased unemployment in this country by 1,000% since Mandela became president. This is the result of ANC policies. Socialism is always the pathway to ruin. Let us rather follow examples of excellence like Singapore, which you'd notice that Helen Zille got into deep trouble when she made a positive comment that Singapore has gone past the colonial past to making a bright future. And you'd have sworn she committed a thought crime. Let us rather follow examples of excellence in Switzerland. I mean, Switzerland is an example of the most decentralized country on earth, the most positive country on earth. They put a plus on their flag. And it's grown out of the Reformation and out of the darkness of the worst times of the Inquisition. They crafted a strong, free country. How did they do it? Because they've got French, German, and Italians. They've got Protestants and they've got Catholics and even some Romans. Well, they do it by such a decentralized model that it doesn't matter that you may disagree violently with your neighbor because they've got no power of your life. They don't have a central government that's got any strength. Everything's down to the local, regional, municipal, canton level. And decentralization is the model for progress. That's the model. If you want to get poverty, go centralization and socialism. If you want to get prosperity and freedom, go decentralization. It's biblical. Create tax havens. Notice some of the richest places in the world. Hong Kong, Macau, Singapore, Luxembourg, Switzerland, Channel Islands, Bermuda, Bahamas. What do these places have in common? Tax havens. People like to take their business and invest and move to a place where they're not going to have everything confiscated by socialist taxes. And so if we want Cape Town to be booming, do you know Hong Kong had a bigger economy than the whole of Red China? Now, you'd miss that right now because now Hong Kong's economy is added to Red China's economy so they can, it makes it look like China's really soared. That's because they amalgamated with British-run Hong Kong in 1997. So if you put a chart, like, wow, China's... Yes, but it's mostly from Hong Kong, actually. It's the tax havens. Hong Kong doesn't even have enough water for itself. It doesn't have any natural resources. A small area, but it's got a tax haven, free enterprise, and boom. If we want prosperity and freedom, we need to respect life and property. Like, just take the Netherlands, where many of our ancestors come from. And boy, do you see farms well-run. Talk about well-run, even color-coded. So the Netherlands is just extraordinary. And the church is at the center of it, time and again. The only hope for our country is to turn away from race politics and hate. We need to love one another. We need to turn to God in humility, to humble ourselves, and pray and seek his face and turn from our wicked ways, then God will hear from heaven. He will forgive our sins and heal our land. I've got lots of hope for the Cape. every one of us on the day of judgment will one day stand before Almighty God and give an account for every word we've ever spoken. I thought that while I was sitting in that hideous, hideous parliamentary hearings and hearing the hate and the insane, stupid, mindless, evil utterances of so many. I thought, you will have to stand before Almighty God one day and give an account for what you've said. And for those who weren't there and who didn't want to stand up and speak out, they'll have to give an account for what they didn't do and didn't say, for not standing up. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one will receive the things done in the body according to what he's done, whether good or bad. So, we've written already on Farms and Freedom Under Fire in South Africa, and the 9 stages to genocide in South Africa, and fearless farmers who fight back, those on those newsletters. We've got videos of those previous ones on our website. Articles, you'll see if you go onto our reformationsa.org website, a whole range of links to videos and audios. Also on our Reformation 500 Facebook page. There's books on history which backs it up. If you go on the Henry Morton Stanley website, you'll find a lot of these presentations in video form of these evening presentations from Thursday nights, also articles and also links to the audios. And on our social media page, HMFS or Henry Morton Stanley School of Christian Journalism, we've got more. If you go on the video and audio gallery of the Frontline Mission essay, you'll get many of these links in their different categories under history or reformation or political and so on. And every Tuesday night on our From the Frontline podcast, we are tackling different issues like these and sharing them widely. So these are just some of our platforms, but all got one goal: destruction of every high thought raised against the knowledge of God, taking every thought captive. So any questions, any comments?
Farms already on a list, and they don't want to declare it because there might be a court case against them. They swear it is the case, and obviously the adversary. What are your comments on that?
Well, Michelle, maybe you've got a better understanding because you're right there in Parliament, and you know something about those names, 139 farm names they've already released.
Yeah, 2 of them are in the Western Cape. As I understand it, they don't want to release them because of the source that they have, that they got it from, and they're afraid that if they release the source as well, that the source is going to be killed. But they believe that it is the list that's being circulated at the moment, but they might change some of the farms. So it's not a sick list, but it does look like it might be the list for sure.
So it's a test case?
Yes.
What's key is that we make a stand and we fight on these. It's so important not to let them get away with anything. So I think this is a ploy. There is no way that Cyril Ramaphosa thinks this is actually going to help things or help South Africa economically or really help the poor. But they're coming up to elections next year. The ANC has been steadily losing votes. This is a vote-catching public relations gimmick. But also, it's second phase of the revolution. Can they get away with it? I think they're taking a big gamble. There's a whole lot of things that may or may not work. But plainly, you've got to fight them on every foot. Because if you let them take these 139, well, then they're going to go for the next few thousand.
This issue is extremely serious because of the potential domino effect it could have. I read a write-up on it saying that one of the effects would be the collapse of the banks, and if the banks collapse, then the whole economy will collapse.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been
all these farms have bonds and
business with thieves.
Who's going to want to invest in this country if your investments aren't guaranteed? But we saw how this played out in Zimbabwe. The dollar became worthless, tourism disappeared, investment disappeared, and the people were starving. It's just disastrous. Every single thing the Zimbabwe government did to try and rectify the situation made it only worse. A good government shouldn't interfere with private ownership. So, for example, you just take the way the media works. I'm talking about the secular humanist media now. They call a president like Obama a good president because he passes lots of laws. And then they'd look in history at somebody like Calvin Coolidge or Harding as bad presidents. Why? Because they passed almost no laws. But then Calvin Coolidge, who was a dedicated Christian, as his first name should indicate, Calvin Coolidge said, the business of government is business. We must. The business of America is business. My job as president is to keep government off the business's back, that they can get on with the business of running America. And so his job was to basically veto or refuse to sign almost any laws into being, because unless it was restricting the powers of government, he wouldn't give them more powers, more taxes. Now, those sort of people often, when they say, who's the greatest president and so on, they look for the ones who caused wars, bombed people, destroyed things and so on. They were great presidents. But the ones who actually mind their own business and quietly and calmly kept within the rules and laws, they aren't considered very good in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of the secular world. But in the eyes of God, those are the ones who may be hearing, well done, good and faithful servant. So, yes, just like when you look at church history, at Bible history, some people would say, if you are looking at it from a purely secular point of view, that apparently Omri, one of the kings that you barely notice in the Bible, would have been one of the greatest kings of Israel. But that's not the way God and inspired word sees it, because he did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. And so the world's got its own scheme. So some people, just like the fact that they all sing the praises of Obama or Mandela and so on, but it's because socialists believe more government's the solution, whereas we believe less government's the solution. When it comes to when people speak about what's the freest country in the world, I'm not thinking America, I'm thinking Switzerland, Iceland. Iceland, they locked up the bankers and the politicians who colluded with them over the 2008 derivatives bubble, which deprived hundreds of, well, not just hundreds of thousands of people, but millions of people, tens of millions of people with savings, earnings, pensions and so on, and jobs and homes. Well, in Iceland, they forgave all the debts to the people and imprisoned the bankers and the politicians. Now, that seems like the right way to go about things.
Does anybody know the president of Switzerland's name?
Nothing. Or Iceland. You know, I mean, it's the small, quiet, mind-your-own-business countries that don't bomb anyone who are actually the good examples. That's why, you know, our model should not be to follow the ones who are causing the most trouble. Other comments? Questions?
I want to ask you your comment on Magnus Malan and all this things that's going on around him.
I don't know anything about it. You've got to tell me.
Pedophiles.
He's a pedophile, isn't
he? Using colored children. And the person exposed it apparently possibly assassinated.
Assassinate who?
Well, I say he shot himself, but I think he's more...
It's amazing how many people who expose scandals commit suicide. We've got a term for it in military speak about them being suicided. A good assassination is made to look like a suicide. So I generally assume that controversial people who die by suicide are normally suicided. Just another term for murder. Like, expropriation of compensation is now a euphemism for stealing. In the army, we used to speak about liberating, so because the enemy liberated things. So, can I liberate some of your... there'd generally be... It's just a euphemism for stealing. And so now I believe some people are talking about, can I expropriate some of your sweets without compensation? So, you know, it just enters into the vocabulary of it. Other comments? Misha, anything you can add from your insights? Because you know more about what's going on in this than I do.
I'm just very concerned. I think I'm very, very concerned. And I think I look around, you know, a lot of people are still sort of living in this false sense of security.
It's a very false, terrible sense of security, false sense of security. The amount of people I've heard saying, Christians even, so, who should know better, saying, no, it's going to be right, because Sora imposed a short list, it's not going to harm the economy. Like, have they not heard anything he said?
I've been hearing a lot of it's going to be fine because they can't do that. And it's sort of like people don't realize, but they can, mm. and they will, and they say they're going to, so you can take us to the bank.
You know, it's never, ever, ever, ever been done right. How on earth could it possibly work this time? Mm.
I'd have to ask any opinions, particularly from you, or the Chief Justice, I can't remember his name. Is
yes.
he trying to smooth troubled waters?
Well, he's meant to be a Christian. Do you know anything about him?
No.
Because he's done some surprisingly good things, but he was a personal friend of Zuma.
I was making a statement recently, you know, trying to calm things, but I don't know how far it goes, you might know more.
I think a lot of them are very afraid at the moment to make any mm. sort of statements that are going to make them seem reasonable, because they might end up being dead as well.
Yes. Mm.
Yes.
You know, the Armenians, the Christian Armenians, they
yeah.
knew that trouble was coming, and they didn't prepare.
Oh, the Armenians
yeah.
in Armenia, yeah.
And they were slaughtered. And we need to prepare. Mm. Trouble is coming. They're coming for our land. They're coming to kill your wives and your children.
Mm.
That is what is going to happen. The men of war need to draw near, as the Bible says. The men of war need to draw near. We are in trouble. This country's in trouble.
Mm.
You know, the thing of communism is this. That is to take. They have said it repeatedly. I mean, I heard it EFF say they don't care if the economy collapses mm-hmm. and you have no food to eat and their people have no food. Destroy everything and then start over. Then we'll start over. You see?
Yeah.
Then all mm-hmm. everybody that's gathered in their lives, like my father has worked, and he paid his ass off now. I mean, and he's an old timer. You know, we'll be gone.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be gone. We are in trouble.
That is Marxist dialectic. So they speak about, Lenin speaks about constructive chaos, which is, you know, it's like the Big Bang theory of social science. Blow everything up and out of it will come utopia. And there's some people actually believe it.
What, when they said reconciliation would be this. We let Mandela out. We had free elections. Right, now reconciliation would be, okay, we've got a nice Niederberg farm there. Okay, we're going to give it now to our people. How much is the farm worth? 25 million, give it to the farmer. We're taking your farm, but yes, 25 million. Isn't that reconciliation?
It's not like they don't have the money.
You know,
they're spending the money on worthless things.
Mm-hmm.
They're stealing the money.
On incompetence, like mm-hmm. in the SAA. So you've got to keep bailing out incompetent people who are running.
They're probably stealing
it.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
not even counting theft, just incompetence.
I mean, that's what reconciliation is. You forgive,
well,
and then you compensate, take the person, and then give him the land, but you pay the gentleman for his land.
And bear in mind, it's worth more than market value, too, because there's you've poured your heart and soul and life. But there's more than that. Bear in mind, where were we in 1994? In 1994, we were on the brink of a civil war that would have made Rwanda and Yugoslavia look fairly tame. We were an armed camp, and on every side, we were literally at the edge. I was signed up with General Fillion's commandos as well, and I had my kit already organized, webbing the lots. I was ready to be called up. He had 88,000 people just on his commando. For the Freedom Alliance to call us up. And the Zulus, they were organized. And Siskai, Brigadier Opa Gorza's people. We were all ready to fight. Everyone was ready to fight. And they came out of the negotiation process that included, well, basically, remember, we'd won the war in Angola, we'd won the war in Southwest, we'd won the war here. We were so victorious. The Cubans had left Angola, the Russians had left Eastern Europe. The Berlin Wall had come down, the Iron Curtain had collapsed, the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, the red flag came down, the old Russian flag went up, the white, blue and red, and the Soviet Union was dismantled, the Warsaw Pact collapsed. It was euphoric. I mean, those of us who lived through 1989 to 91, after all, we had such battles. And up in Angola, we'd gone from counterinsurgency to conventions. We were fighting tank battles up in Angola. It was ops modular, these were full on destruction of entire mechanized divisions of the Cubans. Russian MiGs were having dogfights with our Mirages, and we were winning. We shot down vastly more of theirs than they shot down of ours. But it was a hard battle, and when the Soviets fled, the Cubans fled, peace came, we'd won the war in Angola, and the Cold War had been won, Ronald Reagan had won, the Nicaraguan Contras had won, the Afghan Mujahideen had won, Solidarity in Poland had won. Even Ceausescu got shot by his own army on Christmas Day 1909, the climax of an incredible year. So those of us who came out in 1909, it was like, you know, we've won the Cold War, something we never thought would happen in our lifetime. The Berlin Wall came down. And from that position of phenomenal strength, the Southern Defense Force was never stronger. South Africa's economy was super strong. We had nuclear bombs. We had 8 nuclear weapons in hand. We had an incredible program that could have planted a nuclear bomb almost anywhere in the world if we needed to. And from that position of strength, we released Mandela, unbanned the ANC, and there was agreement. Okay, the price of no war is, this is how it's going to happen. And rule of law, private ownership property, Section 25, the whole deal, etc., etc. And the whites kept control of the army and the police for the first 5 years. So from 94 to 99, Mandela did not control the army or the police. Most people forget, oh, you know, no, Mandela was so... Well, Mandela had no choice. He did not have the power. He, in fact, even in the Invictus film, Mandela's character even says, but the whites still control the army, the police, and the economy. And, so, and which was true, we did. All that changed in 99. But still, it was part of the handover, the smooth handover, but the agreement was still, respect the constitution, we had to be a Reichsstaat, a constitutional state, ruled by law. Not a democracy, a constitutional state. Rule, not by 51% can oppress the rest. Rule of laws, respect for private ownership, property, and all the rest of it. It's vital. So, all of this avoided war. If you violate the solemn agreement made at the cusp of victory, and it's not the way the schools are trying to tell you now that the ANC won the war and they were gracious to their defeated enemy. They lost the war, we won the war, and we were gracious to our defeated enemies. If they now violate that solemn trust of this internationally agree on settlement, the result would be catastrophic on the lines of the Yugoslav Civil War, which people would have to be a little bit older to remember, but that Yugoslav Civil War was really bloody, very bad, because you had 6 different nations who had been forced into one country, Yugoslavia, thanks to the Versailles Treaty. And when it broke up, I mean, the Serbs, the Croats, the Bosnians, all fighting to break away. And of course, they hated that they were forced to be together. In this country, we've got 11 ethno-linguistic people groups, minimum. Venda, KwaZulu, Transkei, all the rest. This would be, we would break, it's not a matter of South Africa breaking into 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. We could break into 10 or 11. Different countries, easily. The only way we can work together is if we respect one another and respect our neighbours and respect life and property. But when you've got a government inciting genocidal race hatred and slandering the neighbours and accusing some of the most law-abiding, hard-working, diligent people who wouldn't steal a cent from someone, but they land thieves, and this is just a recipe for this is war talk. So either they want war or they want peace. And if they want peace, you can't talk like this or act like that. If they start taking people's farms, what their great-great-great-great-grandfather and so on have been fighting for and have hacked out of the wilderness, even then, if you claim that my great-great-great-grandfather might have herded his cows across this farm once, so what? What do you want? I mean, they don't want the farm, actually. They just want some money, which the government could give them if they really wanted to. But the point is, it's not the piece of land now. It's what you've built on it. It's what you've done with it. You know, it's like somebody can have a stick of wood and someone else has carved something out of it. Now, obviously the carving is more valuable than what the raw material was and so on. So if the people can just remember, and of course these idiots in the EFF, most of whom are under 25, they don't remember because they weren't here. They don't remember we were at the point of, and there were those of us like me who were perfectly happy to keep fighting. I felt no sense of obligation that we need to stop the war. I'm very sorry we stopped the war. I was very happy to be continuing to fight, and I'm sorry we ever stopped, because in the war we were all safer. Mm. Now in peace. 25,000 people being murdered a year? This is much worse than the war. This peace on the ANC is much, much, much more bloody, and they're going for the old people, and they're going for the farmers and the pensioners. So there's many of us who are so sorry that our leaders ever agreed for peace with these treacherous people. So ANC is just cruising for one hang of a fight. If they keep going down this path, it might get... But the trouble is if they egg one another on, as you listen to these imbecilic comments being made at this hearing, you think, if this really represents the average population out there, there's no hope for this country. There's no hope for good race relations. We're going to have ethnic cleansing, genocide, all sides, every way. Nobody will be able to stay in the same area with different races. You'll all have to move to different areas, and they will kill anybody of the wrong race in each area, just like they did in Yugoslavia or in Rwanda. And that's the only way. But I don't believe it represents this country. I think it just represents these active measures, politicians are messing around with everything, and what they bust in there doesn't represent the average population. If it did, this country would have no hope. If they really are that stupid and that malicious. But the thing is, if they dare go that way, you know, when people are saying war, there is no alternative. We only stop the war on the basis of agreeing to respecting property. So if they keep down this path, and the trouble is you've got these idiots down there like Juju, who don't even know what they're talking about because they never lived under apartheid. So they might really even believe their propaganda after all. I don't know.
Have the whites got the ability to combat?
Yes.
The weapons and all that?
Sure. We've got a lot of armed citizens in this country who've got SADF training, and not just that, but just think of how the police lose their weapons and the army lose their weapons so fast that if there's a war, you could upgrade your weapons very quickly. Mm. It's not difficult because... In a war, all rules are off. And you can see how undisciplined the present national forces are. Now, but it's not just that. There are tens of thousands of South Africans who've gone overseas selling their military skills because they can't get employment here. So we've got personal friends of mine even who are working for the British, the Americans, fighting Afghanistan and all over the place and so on, and people doing military executive outcomes. There's a lot of South Africans who've kept their military skills honed over the years, who've got a lot of other friends. And I even bumped into people, Australia, America and so on, and overseas, even Switzerland. I've got people who've said to me, if the war gets hot in South Africa, let us know, we'll be there in a shot. And, I mean, and they'll bring friends. So when we were fighting in Rhodesia had a lot of foreign volunteers. They came from Canada, they came from Australia, New Zealand, all over the world. A lot of South Africans too. But many people fighting in Rhodesia, because Rhodesia was on the front line fighting communism. Now, there's a lot of people very concerned about what's happening with the farmers. And so there's a lot of anger and hostility. If it comes to a shooting war, we would get a lot of our old South Africans back, and we'd get a lot of friends coming with. There's many people who've trained their lives to be soldiers, and they're looking for a good cause. If the Cape broke away, for example, or the Transvaal reinstated itself, or the Free State, or whatever, I know a lot of people who would jump at the opportunity. And so these Kentucky Fried Chicken addicts and DSTV addicts, they're not going to be much of a contest. So yes, the trouble is, if it comes to war, a lot of people die, a lot, on both sides, obviously. But this won't be two sides. South Africa's chaos. Why the British thought that they could have this unified situation in South Africa, and to force the Boer republics and Natal and the Cape all together in one without giving us a chance of openness. It apparently started with the dominions that they first had this opportunity of uniting all of the different colonies of Canada together in one dominion, and then Australia. They thought those were so swimmingly successful, it'll work here in South Africa too. But of course, we're not North American, we're not Australia. We had a whole lot of other confusing elements which didn't make it as easy to. But the British bludgeoned this country into becoming one union. Not that any of us we ever asked whether we thought it was a good idea. They just made it happen. And there's so many people killed and exiled from the country during the Anglo-Boer War that there wasn't much resistance after all. But now, the ANC is coming along and they're wanting us to be a minority in our own country, and they want us to be scapegoats for everything wrong in the country, which we know has been done by their policies anyway. They want to lie about us. And they want to be able to murder and torture people at will. How long does one take that before people fight back? So this is a path of insanity. And it would be better to avoid it. But will they avoid it? Yeah. Are there any voices of reason amongst them? I would have liked to have seen something from the floor. We had 23 members of Parliament apparently on the platform. And not one of them stood up to speak for, you know, just a point of order, or, and it's meant to be a sitting of Parliament, no less. And it was obviously a farce. So, what on earth can we expect from them? But then again, if you had somebody like President of America stepping in and saying to these people, don't even think about it. That could make a big difference. Well, I don't know. But if they would, if some heavyweight overseas said, listen, if you want this, this, and this, you better just behave yourself. After all, they meant to do that to North Korea, so maybe. Yes.
If I'm mistaken, there is a, what do you call, I received something on my cell phone, well, God willing, it's not fake news now, but it mentioned that the United States, the European Union, and Australia, and the, what do you call, the, what do you call, the lady, is it May, from
yes,
mentioning that they will not tolerate what is presently being proposed by the South African government concerning land issues. It is very clear.
Well, that would be sensible, because how much investment have they got over here to all these different countries? It would mess up so many things. Interesting, as I was flying up to Joburg and back for just Thursday for this Krachter last week, first of all, just looking at those farmers, what an incredible bunch of farmers we've got in this country. They're just so resilient. And they're all at this Krachtuck, it's a festival where they're basically looking at different machines and tools. And you looked at these people, who even needs a government? I mean, these people are doing everything for themselves. Everything, electricity, their water, their whatever's got to be done, and their security, they've got solutions, engineering. What a bunch of unbelievably resilient farmers. We must have the greatest farmers on earth. And those people, I was speaking at the security workshop, and there's no one there with a mind to giving in, giving up, or handing over. I mean, these people are they're not wanting a fight, but they would feel relieved almost if it came to that rather than giving in. So, just looking at that. But in the airports, while we're queuing for these stupid security checks, they've got their why South Africa's best investment. They have a whole lot of things why you've got to invest in South Africa. And they went through, you know, South Africa's the largest economy in Africa, and South Africa's got the best this in Africa, and everything is in Africa. I'm thinking, well, so what? Of course we, you'd hope so. That's not saying much. Say where we rank in the world. We used to be able to rank well in the world. We were a first world country. Right now, all we can do is say, we're the best in Africa on this and the best in that in Africa. And I was looking at this thinking, is there anybody believing in all this? Because this is propaganda telling you must invest. Who wants to invest in a country where they might confiscate your investment? So, you know, you've got to be deaf, dumb, blind and stupid to fall for this. But this is just an advertising scheme I saw on the screen and it didn't seem awfully convincing at all to me. Because everywhere I've travelled as well, when I went up to Bloemfontein a few weeks ago and Joburg, I'm hearing from farmers and entrepreneurs, no farmers building anything. Some aren't even ploughing for next year because they don't know. And so you can imagine, just like in Cape Town, if you were a pool services person, you're out of business. If you're garden services, you've lost most of your customers, and so on and so forth. Well, now, imagine if you are a person, kind of person who provides different services for farms. Well, then you're out of business. How many farmers are doing extensions, expansions, upgrades, improve? Many of them aren't even planning to plant for the next year. So, just think how the ripple effect that this is having on many people's lives. Some people are just eking out and managing. And now suddenly you get these water restrictions in Cape Town, which they say has cost small businesses 40% of their business. And many of these businesses are struggling to survive anyway. We're some of the most overtaxed people in the world. And so all of this is pushing, and it's making life for everybody harder. So this is not intelligent. And you'd hope that some people with clout could sit down and speak to the people at the top and say, listen, this is the way it's got to be. You would hope. But maybe they're all cowards too. I don't know. That remains to be seen.
It's also good to know that the constitutional judge, if you look at his comments concerning the land issue, you can see that he's not agreeing with what's happening. He made it very clear under the present, the kind of hatred that people have in their hearts, they cannot take this any further than where he is at the moment. He made it very clear it's not going to work out.
Well, yeah? I've heard people say, including a British advocate who's analysed this, saying, there is no way this is legal. It's not legal by our laws, not legal by international laws, or our treaties, or our constitution, and so on. So basically, if this is challenged in the Constitutional Court, which I'm sure it has to be, they've got to throw it out. Mm-hmm. At that point, the government's going to decide, are you going to go with the Constitution, or are you going to try and overthrow it all? And don't expect these people to go the legal route. That's the point. Of course, if they're rational and legal, well, it's put there to safeguard us from from going over the edge of the cliff. But if these fools go ahead with us, the Cape will secede, and a lot of other places will secede. Because there's no choice. If central government starts to declare war on its own people, then a whole lot of people are going to secede. There's no other way. And at that point, well, of course, there'll be a fight. But the moment there's any kind of acts of genocide or things like that, you will see ethnic cleansing. And it will be vicious. Because those people who suffered for so long aren't going to really take it out. And the causes will be chased out of the Cape so fast. Because and the trouble is a lot of innocent people die with it, but this is the only way it goes. And I ministered in Yugoslavia before and after the civil war and during it, and Rwanda as well, and so on. So I know how these things work.
Just one last comment.
Yes.
In fact, I think what we've seen on the screen this evening and even other days, you've got the what you call the actual ammunition about the truth, what is taking place. In fact, to fight this in a legal court, I think you have all the material on this, on your presentation that you gave us. So, over this presentation, it's so important. Any reasonable person will come to the conclusion that what you have said here is a truly a heart matter, and that if it goes any other ways, it will be the wrong way.
Yes.
In fact, with your experience and what you had shown on this on the screen, is something that the others need to see. Well, others don't know about this.
Thank you. That's why I've screen captured it, the video, and Angela will get it up on our video gallery soon. So the goal is that we will, what you will have is that these presentations that have been given, all of them, they're really being laid up, second phase of the revolution, farms and freedoms under fire and so on. And this one will be known for failure and fast. Mm-hmm. Now, for your interest, because the presentation is given with pictures, the video will be as far as the presentation. But if you go on sermon audio, it'll have the Q&A time as well, the discussion, because that's without the picture. So the video will be shorter, the whole presentation audio-wise will be as long as the Q&A goes on. So that's if you want to share it with others, it's easy. It's very easy actually on the web how to share either a video as a message or on your page on social media, or even just to give a person the link in a letter by email so they can quickly find a way to the web, to the article, or to the PowerPoint. Because I do realize that in many cases it's the visuals that convince the documentation. Because we can use good arguments, but good photographic evidence is more convincing. So that's why we will share the PowerPoint, but we'll also share the whole video as well, which for most people will. Any other comments, observations? I'm hoping that in what we're publishing and writing and sending out and putting out, we're trying to put ammunition in the hands of people who are friends overseas, friends locally. If we can, this is an information war right now. Right now the battle is for hearts and minds. It's my people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. So information is our first battle. Second is intercession, mobilizing prayer. Thirdly, this implementation, things we've got to do. And for us, there's one very positive thing we all can do, aside from the information battle and intercession, is we're heading up to an election in about 9 months' time. Now, this election could be our most volatile since 1994. But it's so important that we convince our friends not to waste our vote on any of these secular humanist parties. The DA, NC, EFF, they're all the same. They're worthless. They can only vote for Christian pro-life, pro-family parties. Freedom Front, Cape Party, ACDP, CDP, those are like your only options. If you want to vote Christian, and all of them are open to decentralization and even secession. So if we can strengthen those parties, they will work together in alliance anyway. But we cannot, right now, the vast majority of Christians in this country are voting DA and ANC. The vast majority. I even know Christians, people who used to be members of the ACDP who've joined the EFF. If you can believe it. I've met them, spoken to them. What on earth is going in their minds, I have no idea. But the fact is, there's obviously millions of Christians in this country voting for secular humanist antichrist parties, for whatever reason. And to convince them to not waste their votes on those secular parties, but rather to vote for parties that have a strong Christian decentralized state vision. I mean, just basic rule of thumb is, do you believe in private ownership of property, or do you think you can take away the safeguard or right to life? These are critical. And if we can persuade a lot of our people not to waste their votes on those other things, that could make a big difference. If they could just realize the ANC, the EFF, and the DA are leading us over the cliff into chaos. We can't go that way. And while the DA is not as bad as the ANC, they still made of the same mold. They're still pro-homosexual, pro-abortion, and all these other things. And they also believe in a whole lot of strange things, which actually undermines the whole of the rule of law in this country. So, and just the fact that they weren't even willing to make a stand at this hearing in Cape Town, which is meant to be their stronghold, is inexcusable. Mm. The DA should have swamped that place out so that the EFF barely had a voice. How easy would that be if they wanted to? So for them to have a little party across the streets is shame.
Remember,
total shame. Anyway, so the elections come up as critical. So just from a point of Cape independence goes, the more people you've got who aren't part of these secular humanist views in Parliament and in the provincial and municipal, the better our position will be. We need more elected representatives who can speak up for us. It's critical. If we don't have that, we're fairly sunk on a legal base, because you can't just do a publicity stunt like the King Cornelius so-called. That's not going to achieve a thing. We need legal elected representatives. Misha, anything you'd add? Because I'm sure you might have noticed things that I said that aren't accurate from what you know, so just correct whatever.
No, I think it's very accurate. And I think the DA's principles on the land expropriation is changing quickly, because they're realizing that if they don't change it, they're going to lose their voting base. So it's going to change a lot more towards ANC,
EFF policies. I'm already seeing
it. Then there's even less reason for taxpayers to be voting for them.
I think that's probably why they didn't really make much of a statement when we were at
the they thought that alienates potential supporters.
That's why they went across the street so that they can show that they were there, but not inside, so that they sort of separate.
That's worthless.
Smart, but worthless. That's the deal.
They really need to be exposed.
Yes, they do. But people don't listen, mate. They think, they think DA and they think Helen Villa, and they don't think that's completely changed.
But she trusted
yes.
Cruella de Vil and Mizzi. So, honestly, even if she is as pure as the driven snow, wonderful, which she isn't, her judgment was obviously flawed at the least.
Yes.
I mean, at the least.
Very ambitious woman in a very bad way. You can be an ambitious person in a good way, but very ambitious in a very bad way.
Well, that alliance with PAC's DeLille was a bad alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And her successor, Mirzi, considering he's so willing to stab in the back so fast, her judgment is obviously flawed.
I think the reason why she came out with a statement about the colonisation and how it wasn't that bad is because she knew DA's a sinking ship, so there's nothing really to hold on to. There's no real reason for her to stay. So I don't think it really mattered to her what was going to
happen. Well, there's a lot of people who've trusted her, and that's why they're supporting the party.
She's taller than Heather. That's the kind of thing she's taller than Heather.
Looks like they need this mental themselves.
Does she have children?
I think so. I think she's got a husband, although that's very hard for me to imagine, but...
Well, you know, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump, he manages to get all his children and his ex-wives to support him. It's just...
Very telling.
That's quite impressive.
The thing is, Peter, you know, each one of us has got a responsibility. If we want to save ourselves, we have to start working at our homes, with our friends. We've got to really start seriously talking politics, because this is the last chance that we have to talk politics and to have a chance to win in the election.
Yes.
Or get a majority, whether we have to form coalitions or not, that will have to happen.
Yes.
And we can only do it if we stand together, irrespective of these different parties that want the cape to succeed. Because that is the only way out.
You go down to the Titanic or you launch out?
We will have to launch out. There's really no other way. And we, each one of us here, got to spread the word amongst themselves, amongst their friends, and amongst their family, and convince those people to do exactly the same. There's no more time to sit back and just say, "Ach no, I will not going to vote."
Mm-hmm.
If you're not going to vote, you in fact vote for the ANC or the EFF or whatever the case might be. The people don't realise the seriousness of it, and we that do realise the seriousness got to speak up, got to go out and do the thing.
I've met people, Christians, this week, who told me they've never voted. People older than me never voted. Interestingly, I've never missed an election, neither municipal nor national one. Considering the amount that I've travelled, that's quite extraordinary, because I couldn't always plan my travels that well, but it so happened I've never missed a vote. Or referendum or anything like that. So I'm glad that I've been able to vote. But the amount of people I know, including my own brother, who's never even registered to vote, just staggers the imagination. All of us must know people who either haven't registered to vote or who haven't voted. We could just persuade some friends and family. That would be a good beginning right there. It's extraordinary. And our churches should speak about our duty to be salt and light and to be a witness. At the moment we have a vote, we don't know that we will for much longer. We must, like Kathy Buckle in Zimbabwe. So we must use it, because if we don't use it, you lose it. And do you know, absolute fact, statistically, more than half of the people who can vote don't vote. amend them and say, what difference could I make? In other words, more people think their vote can't make a difference than the ones that actually vote. Just, and that's not just for South Africa, that's true for America too, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
I've heard this, that there too. Literally, more than half of the people who are eligible to vote either haven't registered or don't vote at all, which means that literally more than half say, what difference can I make? Just like the people, to use the example of plastic straws, what difference can one straw make? But when a few billion people say that several times a week, then that adds up to billions and billions of straws. So again, a lot of people don't understand the power of one. And of course, if we are willing to speak up to others, and we make it easy because there's literature and there's videos and there's social media and there's audios and we can share and so on. And just take, for example, on social media, how many people you can reach. And sometimes you don't even have to create something, you just need to share. So there's so much we can actually do right now with social media and with literature and our neighbours. You've got to stand queues anyway, so you can have a conversation while you're in the queue. And right now, one of the things I talk about a lot is the water. And by the way, you notice we produced the Wonders of Water booklet, which is it's specifically designed for standing in queues of people talking about the water crisis, and my hairdresser and doctors and so on give us this. The first half is basically talking about water from an interesting perspective and how you can save it and so on. Second half gets more into what the scripture says about it, which is absolutely extraordinary. There's so many points of contact that we can use. Anybody in Cape Town is thinking water. And now most people should also be thinking property, section 25 of the Constitution and so on. How many people haven't even read the Constitution? But we've got copies, and by the way, you can just pick them up free at Parliament, can't you? I've walked in there sometimes and taken them. We've got them on the shelves here. It's good for our people just to know, but bad times are good for spiritual work. So the moment things are uncertain, and right now we're in an uncertain phase now, as long as I've had memory, I've lived in crisis of apocalypse now, any moment coming over the horizon. I mean, from time I was 5 or 6, Rhodesia was at war already, and just think through my life. The crisis has changed as time's gone on, but there's always been, you sort of lurch from one crisis to another. That's part of the fun of being in Africa. But it's not like people aren't facing different crises in other parts of the world. And having travelled this year to Australia and last year to America and Europe and so on, I still prefer our problems to the other ones. Because others have got some serious, serious problems too. Really, when you get down to it, I'm not tempted in an instant to miss our problems or to run away from our problems, because I know I've just run into other problems too. These are our problems. We're going to face and we're going to fight and we're going to win, and we're not going to put up with anything these creeps are coming out with. And the Cape has got a brilliant opportunity to be a shining light, and we are surrounded, and you see it when you fly, by desert and mountains and ocean, and we're a very defendable section. We're not like some poor place, unlike Rhodesia, we're not a landlocked country. The Cape is, we've got a lot going for us, but everything we need right here, and we can be one of the most successful countries in Africa. So this isn't saying we don't care about the rest of the country or the continent. I mean, as a mission, we go all over. But we've got to keep our freedom, so if we can continue sending missionaries and caring for and being good neighbour. And I expect KwaZulu may either secede before us or just after us. They'd probably be, whether it's KwaZulu or the Cape first or second, and then others will follow. But right now, the whole thing's unravelling. And what you're seeing is a stupid, irresponsible attempt by the ANC to try and keep themselves together by this last-ditch stupid effort of trying to repeal the Constitution and see if they can start grabbing land. And that may keep them afloat for a while, but it'll probably break up the whole thing, because when you break up a contract, why should people stay together? If a marriage covenant is violated by one party, it might break the whole thing, unless the other member is extremely committed to try and bring reconciliation. The other one's teachable. You may just have to go for a divorce. Now, in this case, this is a marriage covenant amongst many nations and millions of people in one country. you violate the covenant on which it's based, a lot of people are going to seek divorce. And that's what secession is. It's not ideal, but it's better than going down with the ship. And so this doesn't mean we don't care about the rest of the South African nations. It just means that in case of loss of cabin pressure, put your own oxygen mask on first before attempting to assist other passengers. And that's the logic. You can't assist other passengers if you're unconscious. So just like we were taught to first aid, gloves, things like that, one-way valves, CPR, all that, you've got to look after yourself so that you can keep caring for others. And so this isn't being selfish. It's trying to save millions of people in the Cape from this disaster that's coming on the rest of the country. But then we hope that example will help others to save lives in other provinces and sections of the country too.
I just want to ask this question. The Cape Party, in the coming election, are they only limited to the Western Cape, or will they also be in the rest?
No. As far as I understand, the Cape Party is only planning to stand in the Western Cape provincially. Which means that you could, for example, vote Freedom Front nationally, Cape Party regionally, for example. Because the Cape Party is not trying to compete on national level.
The Cape Party is starting by going for secession.
Sorry?
The Cape Party is starting by going for secession.
Yes, that is its primary model. And of course, once the Cape goes in secession, the whole goal is, well, how do you live with a multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic background? Tolerance, decentralization, Swiss model, Singapore model, that sort of thing, which makes sense. And tax haven, bring taxation right down, preferably to nothing. Let the Cape attract investors, then we won't have to worry about unemployment, because people, and the right kind of people, pour in here like they did to Hong Kong, Singapore and all that, if you've got a tax haven. All of Africa chases away the very people who can solve the economic problems by overtaxing. So to go exactly the opposite direction, total decentralization, right down to municipal level. Break up the Unicity back into its component parts, let para run para, let Mitchell's plane run Mitchell's plane, and so on. Let the Boerkop run the Boerkop. And that would immediately solve so many problems. Mm-hmm. Because it wouldn't be me resenting what a Muslim's doing or a Muslim resenting what a Christian's doing. It's they're running the areas, we're running ours, and we'll be good neighbours. Good fences make good neighbours.
As a matter of interest, we are looking at this moment into the various six areas of the Cape, which is the poorer ones, because obviously the poorer ones will have to immerse into a stronger one, because each and everyone can be self-sustainable.
Yes.
A self-sustainable
entity. Everything is sustainable if you put power back in the hands of local communities. Everything. Central government is so wasteful and so inefficient.